And welcome to Pop Off. Hi, Mary Jane Pop here. Have we got a show for you. This is a real mix today. We're going to be talking about something that is so tragic. The soldiers that are coming home from Iraq are coming home with a thing called PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And this is, you know, it's like unprecedented, the numbers that are coming back with it. We'll find out why and what we can do maybe to help them out with that. In addition to that, boy, have we got some fun things for you for your home. It's hot out there. It's muggy out there, at least on the West Coast. And I got a funny feeling that on the East Coast is not much different. But first, before we do that, have you ever thought about paranormal and traditional medicine all together? Well, wait. Till you hear what we've got to say on that subject right here on Pop Off. I mean, can you say traditional medicine and paranormal in the same sentence? Well, you can if you check in with Dr. Robert Bobro. He's author of The Witch in the Waiting Room. Now, the good doctor's no slouch, let me tell you right now. He's a graduate of Cornell University and Albert Einstein College of Medicine, 30 years practicing physician, and is currently clinical associate professor in the Department of Family Medicine at Stony Brook University. And he has been published in many, many legitimate medical journals, too. Dr. Bobro, nice to have you with us on Pop Off.
Nice to be here, Mary Jane. It's hot and muggy on the East Coast.
Yes, and is it hot?
Yes.
Yeah, I can imagine this, and we're having some of that muggy weather back here in Sacramento and in the West Coast, so it's kind of like strange for us, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want to talk to you about something. What is your definition of paranormal?
Basically, it's things that we don't understand and can't explain with existing science. I never felt compelled to explain everything that happened using things we already know, because I've seen too many things happen in the last 30 years since I've been practicing that couldn't have been explained until finally they were explained. For instance, bacteria cause ulcers, or the brain makes a naturally occurring type of morphine.
That's incredible.
No one knew these things or understood them.
Doctor, I'm going to ask a favor if you don't mind. Can you speak up just a little bit?
Okay, I can't hear you that well either.
Okay, I'll try and speak up, and we'll both do the
same.
And
so will I.
Terrific. Now, have you witnessed what you would call paranormal in your traditional medicine field?
I haven't. Well, I've been told about it by patients. The closest I came to witnessing something involving a patient, and which is included in the book, had to do with an 80-year-old fellow who was in failing health but not dying, who summoned his family to the dinner table one Sunday afternoon and very methodically apportioned all his possessions while they looked at him and said, "Pop, you know, what are you doing?" And as soon as he had given out the last thing, he put his head down on the table and died.
Wow.
So that happened. He was a patient at a health center that I was working at the time. And his daughter-in-law was the head of the medical records department at the health center, so we got wind of the story pretty quickly. And I was able to speak to his son, who was at the table with him. And it was just the strangest thing to the family, because it was as if he somehow not only knew that he would die, but had some control over the exact minute of it.
You know, it's amazing that you say that, simply because a few years back, when acupuncture kind of became popular, now this is something that's very ancient because it goes back to the Chinese culture, but
yes.
It became popular. and it was looked at kind of real strange. Look at that. They're putting needles in me. And yet now it's very accepted.
Well, when acupuncture was first heard of in the United States in the early 1970s, it existed for 5,000 years, but nobody here really knew about it until the early 70s. A conference on acupuncture was supposed to happen at Stanford University, and the medical school refused to sponsor it.
Really?
They considered it witchcraft of some sort. They wouldn't touch it. And fortunately, the engineering school was willing to sponsor it. So they held the conference. They expected 700 people, and 1,400 people showed up. But the point is, it was so outrageous that the medical profession wanted nothing to do with it. And I have a chapter on acupuncture in the book as something that went from an untouchable thing from the medical profession's point of view to something that health insurance now pays for most of the time, where the National Institute of Health has vetted it for the treatment of certain things like postoperative dental pain, and where studies are done on it frequently and give a sense of what it does and doesn't do, but it's become more or less acceptable in 30 years' time, whereas it was essentially considered witchcraft when it was first heard about.
The one thing that you mention in your book, which I think is extremely, extremely important, you go all the way back to the Salem witchcraft hunt, mm-hmm. and you say in Salem, you know, they thought the witches were hallucinations and spasms, and you're saying that might have been some form of poison.
Yes, that's largely the work of someone named Linda Caporale, who researched it and published this actually in the 70s, that a fungus called ergot grew on the grain, on the rye that they ate, particularly well under certain types of weather conditions. And she was able to piece together what the weather conditions were to the point of figuring out that there were probably epidemics of ergot poisoning that coincided with the time of these waves of witchcraft behaviors. And in retrospect, that these may have been people who were essentially being on acid trips without knowing it, simply because it was a poisoning from the fungus, ergot being the fungus from which LSD is made.
You know, I think there are many, many amazing things, Doctor, that people don't even want to talk about or will not recognize as being a possibility. But why not? I mean, what is the matter with combining both of them for the betterment of the patient?
Well, a lot of doctors feel if they don't understand something, then it doesn't exist or it didn't happen. But in merely 30 years, I've seen a whole lot of things that didn't exist suddenly come into existence. So why should I think there's something magical about now and not that nothing's going to happen in the next 30 years or 300 years? You know, it will.
The other thing, too, that you had in the book, again, fascinating to me, is that you could not convince, or someone could not convince, a man that he was not a tiger. Are you serious?
Well, this was taken. In fact, almost everything in the book are taken from medical reports. These are published in what's called the medical literature. Journals indexed in the National Library of Medicine because they meet certain standards. They're peer-reviewed. And accessible at PubMed.gov. This was in a psychiatric journal, and it was a report filed basically by the man's psychiatrists. It's called lycanthropy, the delusion of being an animal, which is somewhat uncommon but is known to psychiatrists. And what was several things were unusual about this fellow. They could not cure him of it. Medications, shock treatment, psychotherapy, whatever they tried could not convince him that he wasn't the cat. He had felt from his early childhood, essentially, that he was a human being trapped in the body of a cat. That, you know, in his soul he was a cat and somehow mistakenly placed into the body of a human being.
Is that
yet,
sort of like...
Yet he functioned effectively most of the time. He was president of his high school class. He held a job. Only close friends knew what his feelings were, but most of the people who interacted with this guy or worked with him had no idea, raising the possibility that this could be more common than we think it is because it's concealable.
Is that almost like, you know, you hear about people thinking they're werewolves, you know, and they grow hair and all that stuff?
Well, it's certainly in the same vein. Some of the werewolfery is consistent with certain types of medical diseases, such as porphyria. But the concept that somebody is a wolf is historically common. In fact, in different cultures, when something like this happens, when somebody thinks that they're really an animal, certain things are more common than others. Tigers are common, particularly in Asia. The wolf is common in Europe. The fox is common in Japan. These are not
amazing.
You know, they're not well understood, but they do occur. And
isn't it more of a cultural thing?
Well, the cultural thing may have to do with which animal you think you are. But the irony is, and this was brought out by the authors of the article, in some cultures, particularly developing cultures, somebody like this is seen as special and often becomes the shaman. They have healing powers. So what's an aberrancy in Western culture may be considered normalcy in another culture.
Did you run across reincarnation, which seems to be a big topic these days?
It's not something that I run across in my medical practice, but you have to understand I have a very conventional medical practice. I don't even use alternative medicine. It's a straightforward family practice. Things may go on that I don't know about, and I'm certain they do, because from the little I've found out writing the book, I've realized that a lot of things are going on that I don't know about. For instance, a patient told me once, because she trusted me and felt comfortable with me, that the reason I couldn't control her diabetes, which I couldn't, even though I kept raising her insulin, is that she had multiple personality disorder, and most of her personalities were not diabetic. So I could tell her in the office to raise her insulin, but then she would go home and become someone else who would not believe that they needed insulin. How can you take care of patients and not know that something like this is going on?
That's got to be incredible for you to have to deal with something like that. Now, is it... You know, perhaps it's just there are certain things that we're just not supposed to know about and just accept as part of life.
Well, you never know exactly where the boundary is between man and God. And historically, it's kept moving. Isaac Newton, who essentially discovered gravity and that gravity holds the universe together, couldn't quite figure out why the universe didn't collapse into itself, why it didn't just pull itself together. And he said, well, this is the province of God. This is what we can't know, but what God knows. Then 100 years later, a French mathematician, Laplace, basically developed a new kind of mathematics that explained why the orbits didn't collapse. Then the British electrochemist, Michael Faraday, in the early 1800s, working with electricity and electric eels, felt we were, quote, that he was, quote, on the threshold of what man is permitted to know, unquote. The first telegraph message sent in the 1840s by Samuel Morse from Washington, D.C. to Baltimore was, what hath God wrought? In other words, people looked at electricity as really on the boundary between what human beings are allowed to know and what they're not. Yet today, nobody looks at electricity as if it's anything special or close to God. It's just an ordinary, everyday part of our lives.
You know, the other thing, Doctor, and you don't have to be honest about this. It's my opinion, and this is just my big, bad opinion. It's my show. I guess I can have one. But, you know, everybody has talent. You, as a doctor, have the talent to be able to diagnose, to help people with diseases. Why not then someone who has the talent to be telepathic or, you can know about reincarnation or psychic or mediums or whatever? God gave us all certain talents. Maybe that's their talent.
Well, yes. In fact, as I mentioned in the book, the United States government believed that some of us had telepathic powers and employed them during the 70s and 80s in a secret project, or then secret project, at Fort Meade, Maryland. Three principal psychics were employed by the government to try and figure out what the Russians were doing. And the Russians, meanwhile, employed their own psychics to try to figure out what we were doing. Saddam Hussein had a facility, a secret facility, for people with psychic powers. So apparently there is some belief, or was, in Congress and in government that, yes, people do have psychic powers, and let's make sure nobody else gets an edge on us because of their access to such information.
And I think, you know, perhaps sometimes we just need to accept that there are things that we may not understand and keep an open mind. We have a tendency to have such closed minds. You know, if it's not what I believe, then it's wrong.
Well, that's very true. I never felt compelled to explain everything with what we already know. But it's actually hard to get something published if it doesn't make a lot of sense. I mentioned the bacteria causing the ulcers. The fellow in Australia, Barry Marshall, who discovered that, couldn't get anybody to believe him because everyone knew that bacteria don't cause ulcers. So he had to swallow live bacteria and sicken himself and then cure himself with antibiotics in order to get anyone to believe him. It was that strongly held a belief that couldn't be done.
This is an amazing, these are amazing stories, by the way. It is phenomenal to have someone like yourself who did the research. And what prompted you to even begin this kind of research? Was it because of the patients that you had?
Well, I just found it interesting, too interesting to ignore. I was always interested in things in medicine that were just a little interesting and unusual. They didn't have to necessarily be paranormal, you know, such as bacteria causing ulcers, or a report I saw that donating blood prevents you from having a heart attack. So I would notice that. But then I would notice a little piece in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1981 about an American nurse who got a terrible disease known as lupus. And not much could be done with conventional medicine. So she went back to her native Philippines, was treated by a witch doctor, and came back to the United States 3 weeks later without any residual disease. And her American physician is writing this up, and it's a well-documented account. And he doesn't know how it happened, but he's just honest enough to say, this appears to have happened, I don't know how it happened.
But you know what, I look at it this way, the power of the mind, the power of, if we have the belief that is as small as a mustard seed. Remember that statement? Well, why not? We have no idea what a powerful thing we have in the organ we call the brain.
Well, you have to remember the placebo effect is 40%, no matter whether you're treating cancer or the common cold. So simply believing that you're going to be helped works, at least in the short run, 40% of the time, no matter what you study.
Well, the chances are better that way than in some diseases where they say you have no chance at all.
There are too many diseases like that, although not quite as many as there were when I began medicine 30-some years ago.
Doctor, how do we get the book, The Witch in the Waiting Room? Is it available on Amazon?
Amazon.com is probably the easiest way to order it.
And do you have a website?
I do not.
Okay, not a problem. So it's called The Witch in the Waiting Room. It really explores a lot of the paranormal and traditional medicine. Keep up the good work. We need to make that crossover.
Yes, we do. We need to basically keep an open mind. I look at this as data. Even things on reincarnation, which are largely the work of a psychiatrist named Ian Stevenson, involving children who seem to remember past lives, he doesn't even say that this has to be reincarnation. He calls them cases of the reincarnation type, or cases suggestive of reincarnation. But just as the earth looks flat, but really isn't flat, these look like reincarnation, but we don't know what they are. They could be anything from a problem with our concept of time or our concept of memory or some sort of reincarnation. If you ignore them, then there's nothing to be gained.
Well, we'll keep an open mind. How's that?
That's all I'm asking when I wrote the book.
Dr. Bravo, thank you so much for being with us on Pop Off. It's great information.
Thank you, Mary Jane.
Take care now.
You too.
And keep up the good work. The Witch in the Waiting Room, that's the name of the book. There are stranger things than can be accomplished with explanations, if you know what I mean. That's why we try and give you as much information up front and straightforward on Pop Off. Music means, don't you? That means it's our home improvement guy here with us today, and he's on with his live. What a fun time to have Roger with us. Do you know your home? Well, you will when our pop-off Knowing Your Home guy, Roger Santo, speaks out and speaks up above what's going on. You're speaking out in your music. No way. You got to speak to me one-on-one so we can talk about what we're doing.
You actually want to hear me talk about it. Okay.
You betcha. And not only that, did you hear? Here's Dr. Bravo. He said he's on the East Coast. They're sweltering back there, too. So if they're sweltering, we're sweltering. I can just see the cha-ching, cha-cha-ching, all these wonderful,
Well, you know that the guy is sitting at the top of the energy commission boards and on the service providers, they're all loving it.
Yeah, they're smiling from
ear
to ear.
They're smiling ear to ear. We're draining them, and they love every bit of it.
Okay, so where do we start? Oh, I know this is important because we've got one.
Yeah.
It's an all house fan installation. Now, we've got a fan because we have a two-story house. So in between the first and second and the stairwell, we've got a fan. You're talking about something more extensive, right?
Well, you're talking about a ceiling fan.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm talking about a fan that actually draws the air up into the attic space and actually distributes the air through the attic and out the gable vents, the end vents at the arches of your house.
Oh.
The gables. This basically forces air in through the windows from the outside, through the house, up into the attic, and pushes all that hot air in the attic that's been building up out the gables.
Sort of like the hot air that we have on the show.
It pushes it right on out.
Now, what kind of installation is that? Where are the fans?
Okay, the fan actually sits inside the ceiling joist. You cut a hole in your ceiling, you mount this in between your joists, and the fan has flaps that close up when it's not in use, that lay down flat and seal up. And then when it's turned on, the drawing of the air actually opens the vents up and the air is drawn through. There is no faster way to circulate or change out the air in your house than with one of these devices.
Now, you just put it in one place?
Well, it really depends on the size of the house.
Oh, okay.
How many square feet, and each fan will actually tell you how many square feet it moves per hour of air volume and go through a whole litany of things. What you want to look at is the size of the fan, how much space you're trying to do, and then how many nooks and crannies, turns and hallways and things do you have in the house, because the more turns and everything, the
harder to
less
that
efficient,
air
yeah, depending on the size of the fan, of course, the less efficient it becomes to get to certain parts of the house. Maybe your house requires two.
Okay.
But an all-house fan upstairs can work for the downstairs by sealing the upstairs. You draw all the air through the downstairs, up through the upstairs, and out
Well, usually the upstairs gets hotter anyway.
It always does. And the further up you go, the hotter it gets.
Yeah.
So getting the air exchanged out of your attic and getting it out of the upstairs, or if you're on just a single floor, getting exchanged there, is the best way to reduce the cost of trying to cool your house down. Even if you use this in complement with an air conditioner, if you can at least draw out the stagnant, warmer air,
okay,
then you have less heat to try and cool down with your air conditioning unit.
Ah, are we talking about expensive? I mean, you're going to drill a hole in your ceiling, you're going to put a fan in there, and you're going to do all this vents and all this. That's expensive.
Well, it isn't actually as expensive as it sounds.
Oh, good.
The whole thing is probably about a 2 to 4 hour job tops, depending on your home and what structure.
Are you looking at me to do this?
I am looking at the average homeowner can probably do this.
Really?
If they're handy with tools and they take their time, they follow the instructions, this thing can be installed by the average homeowner. You have to run electrical, of course, up to the fan from a light switch. You do need to be able to use saws and hammers and do some measuring. But the actual installation of this thing is not that difficult at all.
Okay.
If you use the templates and the instructions,
you'll be okay.
It's almost like putting your swing set together.
You said not. Yeah, well, that takes only a 5-year-old. Don't
well,
you have?
Okay, bring the kids in.
I had these guys in the backyard going, I can't read all this stuff. A goes into B into C.
It's 3 a.m.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Still out there trying to put up the swing set. You said the cost is not too high. The average about?
The model of the fan, the size of the fan for the material side of this, is going to be the largest amount of the cost. You're going to need some Romex cable for your electrical. You're going to need maybe some screws and some extra wood to frame off the space that you're going to put this fan into. The overall cost can run anywhere from $100 to $1,500, depending on exactly how extensive you get.
Yeah. I imagine it could be fancier or plainer. Or
there are, and certain fans have better draw than others by design.
Okay.
And those designs do obviously cost more if they're better and more efficient. But the overall cost of running this thing is dramatically cheaper than any other form of cooling your house off.
Yeah, especially air conditioning.
Right. You run a fan, and it's pennies relative to anything else that you've got, your air conditioning unit, whatever local space cooler thing you may have. Swamp coolers, none of those are as inexpensive as this.
I got to ask you about something, because I had someone on Monday, Bob Klebauer, and they have a thing called Power Save. And I'm getting one of these things to try it and see if it actually works. He said that it takes the waste. You put it in your panel, you know, the outside where you have the power.
The electrical panel.
Yeah, thank you very much. You're my guy.
There we are.
You're my knowing your home guy. And he said you put it on there, and because there's always waste when things turn on, turn off, feed, whatever. And it takes any of the waste, stores it in some kind of little compartment. He had the terminology for it. But I said, is that just like a little compartment that says, okay, all the waste stuff is going to sit here? And then you use that before you go to the power company for more electricity.
Well, I'm not familiar with the product, but what I suspect he's talking about is anytime you initiate a device, there's an initial large hit with regards to the power. It's a surge that happens until it levels out. It's a little like putting a nozzle on the end of a hose, closing it off, turning it on at the faucet, go over where you're going to water. And the minute you open that faucet, a big burst comes blowing out of the end of your hose, and then it slowly
settles
out.
Yeah.
Same thing with electricity. Now, perhaps what he's referring to is a storage device, battery, some cell retention device, which allows you to accumulate some of that extra energy that's there and perhaps utilize that as the kickoff or the start, or even incorporate it into the stream.
Yeah, it's kind of recycled what you have as extra waste.
It really depends on how much energy you're using, whether or not that's going to buy you additional.
He said you can save anywhere from 10 to up to 30%, depending on how much you use again, you know.
Yeah.
But 10%, even 10% on a bill, I mean, that's a lot of energy.
It can be.
A lot of money.
It really can be.
It adds up.
And it's also, probably from what it sounds like,
I'll get the information.
A lot safer. Yeah, it's a really good thing to have with regards to controlling that initial punch, because your devices take a real hit. A light bulb will never really burn out while it's on. It's at the time you start it, because that filament takes a real hit when that electricity first hits it. And it's that initial punch that really is the hardest thing on your electrical appliances.
He also said that this power save helps with power surges.
Yeah.
Yeah, he really did. And he said no house is exempt from lightning, but this will eat it. It'll destroy that unit, but it will eat it up. Which I thought was kind of, I'll give all that stats.
Yeah, I'd like to.
And then when
that.
He's back,
yeah,
maybe you can be here and
very much
we can
like
talk to him, because I want to get your read on this. I'm gonna try the darn thing. Are you kidding? My bills
save money.
Wow. Okay, you've got one. It's called solar roof vents.
Exactly. These are just fantastic. We're all used to those big metal balls that kind of spin around on the top of a roof, and the heat basically you're working with just the nature of gravity and the heat rising and all the rest. Escaping from the attic. Well, this is a vent that sits on the roof, kind of profiled, it's flat, and typically in the darker patterns to kind of match in and blend in with the roof. But it has solar panels on the top of it, so there's no electrical wiring to run to the device. It's a fan which draws the air, much like the all-house fan we were talking about, and it's a little bit smaller, but it draws all the heat out of the attic, forcing the heat out of the attic, and drawing the cleaner, cooler air through those gable vents that we talked about, draws it in there, and then pulls it out through the roof, and you can place several of these along a long roof span to really reduce that heat in the attic, because this is our biggest problem. We typically put dark shingles up on a roof because they're nice looking. So something about it is attractive, or depending on even whether you're using composite or you're using tile or whatever you're using. If it's a dark color, it's going to generate heat in the attic. It's going to retain the sunlight and the heat and build it up. Getting that heat out of the attic will reduce the overall bill cost for getting your house cool dramatically.
Really?
Absolutely. That's one of the one things that we're really cooling down. You sit there with this heater on top of your house. You cool down the air in your house, but your ceiling is so hot, it's just radiating heat back into the room that you just cooled down. You need to exchange that air, and exchanging air any place where it could be trapped and built up and just stagnant is key to keeping the house in a nice, comfortable, cool manner.
Okay, now you got one called gable vents.
Gable vents.
Okay.
Now we've moved from a ceiling or a roof-mounted fan that draws electric out to putting these in those gables where we were drawing the gables are the apex. And you've got the A-frame at the end of the house. Those are called gables.
Oh, that's where all the birds try and get
that's
in.
That's where the birds try and get in and everything else. Exactly right. And then all the screening and everything you're trying to do.
Yeah.
So in there's the vent that accesses to the house. There are eave vents. Those are those little tiny holes you see along the eaves of your roof line down low. And air, by design, the way houses are built, the air is to draw in there and then go out these gable vents. And that's the idea for the release of the heat in the attic without any additional device like what we're talking about.
Right.
Now, these fans basically mount right to those gable vents on the inside. Again, working to draw the air from the inside of the attic out and pulling it through. This will work if you have roof vents, even if they're not fan roof vents that are drawing air out that way. If they're just vented well, and those holes, those tiny vents that are along the eaves, are free to allow air to come in. These fans will draw the heat out and essentially draw the air in through those
The outside air in.
Exactly, and clear out the roof. Again, the whole principle behind any of these devices is get that heat out of the attic so that your house stays comfortable.
Yeah, and really, some of the stuff, like when we had 104, 105, I don't think I want to suck that back into the house.
You don't. And that's where it becomes problematic. Now you're looking at, okay, I'm moving the air, which is a good thing.
But am I just exchanging hot for hot?
Yeah, very possibly. Now you're kind of stuck.
I knew it.
The idea is that the evening is going to cool down, and the outside air is going to be very cool, and the inside air is going to be now hot and stagnant, and you want to get it out there.
Gotcha. Okay,
so,
makes sense.
Yeah, when you've got as hot inside as you do outside,
forget it.
Hands up in the air.
Now, what about, you mentioned roofing and how important that is.
Yes.
The type of roofing or the color of the roofing, or both?
Both. Absolutely both. a lot of times, especially in newer tracks, they're going to make these things look beautiful for the least amount of money. So they're going to probably use the thinnest possible sheet of plywood possible to put up there, but still maintain the weight of whatever material they put up there.
Mm-hmm.
The thicker the wood, the better it insulates. The insulation in the attic, pivotal. Got to have good insulation in there. The type of material you put on your roof, if it's composite, that's the shingle, tar, paper type stuff that we're used to, go with the lighter colors.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, absolutely. Go with the lighter colors because they reflect the sunlight and they won't trap as much heat.
Mm-hmm.
And typically what we do is we paint our house in a real nice color and then we try to match that roofing to that so it looks good. But if you're going to live in an area that goes over 100 degrees, you're shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah.
Go with the lighter colors, and if your CCNR throws a fit, work with them because they've got to understand that the energy efficiency required for homes these days and what they have to meet in standards
mm-hmm.
far outweighs somebody's idea of what is aesthetically pleasing.
The other thing that we found, and I thought this was amazing, when we had our roof put on, most of the roofers said, take everything off that you had. This roofer said, no, wait a minute, we'll check and make sure there's no dry rot. If there's no dry rot under there, we had a little bit on the ends, they repaired all that. But he said, essentially, it's doing just fine with the rest of the roof. Put the roof on top of it, you'll have double insulation. And man, have we seen a difference.
Yes. Essentially what he's saying is that the old shingles that are up there will act as an additional layer between the inside and the outside to prevent the heat from coming in. It's an insulator. Tar is a great insulator,
mm-hmm.
But again, the color of the material makes a big difference, and if you put a nice light color on top of that, even more benefit to
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
You put dark on top of dark, that dark just continues to radiate the heat through, but that extra layer of insulation, and now I would caution you, you can't do it too many times. Downside mm-hmm. is, if you have to go and roof again, anytime soon. Now you've got to take off two layers of roofing. It's going to take more time, more material,
and more money.
There you go.
Yeah, they get you one way or the other, I tell you.
They do.
You mentioned insulation, how
yes.
important that is. And we always think of insulation to keep us warm, but insulation keeps us cool, too.
It's a bidirectional product. You really need this thing to, again, abate that heat from coming through. A lot of folks will take and put in a minimal amount of rollout insulation.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's going to help a little bit. But what you can do is you cannot overdo insulation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll qualify that first. You take the minimum rating for whatever your roof is, and all of the big houses that sell all this stuff have all the numbers, and you can check with anybody about what you should be putting into your particular region. Every region is a little different, so I won't call out what R rating we should put in.
Right.
So your region has to be looked at individually. But take the minimum amount, and a good rule of thumb is to take the minimum amount and double it.
Oh.
If you double it, and you're able to actually get that within the joists and framing, it's great. And you want that up and down both sides of your A-frame
mm-hmm.
space. And on the surface part where you've got your ceiling and you've got all your joists, you want to fill that in. Personally, I don't go with roll-out insulation in that particular environment because what I'm attempting to do is actually mask any of the heat from building up in the wood joists and all the rest. It's roll-out insulation fits in between, so you're still mm-hmm. exposing a bit of the wood and that to the warmth to warm up and generate radiating heat through. Not a lot, but it's enough.
Yeah.
Blowing in insulation is a much more effective way to try and get it. And you can really regulate the depth much better as a result.
Sounds good. Now, if people want to ask you some personal questions,
sure.
maybe they have something specific in their own home that they go, oh, you know, I need some help here. And boy, Lord, we all need it.
We all need some help with it.
You know, it's very expensive if you don't know the tips. I call them the tips and tricks.
Absolutely. The tips and tricks, most people will buy a home. It's the most expensive thing they're going to buy, and they know so very little about it. And over time, they go through the learning curve, and they learn some things.
You bet.
But, boy, can it be expensive.
Well, you can learn the hard way, and that costs you.
There's a lot of really good information out there, great books, things. Take your time. Really get to know
what you're doing.
Some of the basic fundamentals about how to take care of your home.
And
it'll help.
Roger.
And ask me.
Like, how do they do that?
www.knowingyourhome.com.
Mm-hmm.
Go onto the page and just put in your question or whatever. You can do a submit. I'll get it. We'll put it out on the air. I'll email you with some information, whatever is appropriate for the question you have.
Excellent. As always, Roger, you have good information for us. It's stuff that is practical and it's doable. You know, sometimes we
it
get
is.
People in that give us these highfalutin stuff. It's like, forget it. There's no
so
way.
So much of what you do around the house, or so much of what can be done around the house, can be done by anybody, whether you're feeling very confident about using tools or not. Most of the things are doable by the individual homeowner.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
As always, Roger.
Oh.
We'll talk with you next week on Knowing Your Home, you big home improvement guy.
You got it.
Thank
I'll be here.
Be ahead of the home game. That's on Pop Off. When the Vietnam vets come home, 1 in 10 will suffer from, well, I should say when the Vietnam veterans first came home, it was 1 in 10 who suffered from post-stress disorders. Now, with Iraq, it's more like 1 in 5, maybe even worse than that, which is really, really frightening. And according to Michael Payne, many troops left the Middle East, but the Middle East did not leave them. It's called PTSD, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, or syndrome, either way that you want to say it. Nice to have you with us, Michael.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
You know, Michael, we really need to understand what this thing called PTSD is.
Well, PTSD has a variety of different symptoms. One of the, it comes, I believe, in my case, from rejection. Rejection of your best efforts by, let us say, your family, or let us say, the nation in the instance of Vietnam vets mainly. And then they would come home and their parents wouldn't understand them, their wife wouldn't understand them, and they would just be clammed up. Sleeplessness, not being able to go to sleep because your head is so busy. Waking up in the middle of the night in cold sweats with nightmares. From nightmares, of recurring nightmares, maybe even situations of nightmares that you never were in but would come into your imagination. Anger and rage, bitterness, unforgiveness. Vietnam vets, for instance, angry at this nation for not respecting their best efforts. They were drafted in many cases, some enlisted, joined the military to fight communism. A heart compassionate for a people who couldn't help themselves, and considered themselves lucky to survive the situation and then come home, walk off the airplane and be told, don't wear your uniform, don't tell anybody that you're in the Army and just getting back from Vietnam as you would come through meeting protests and et cetera. And with the in the case of Iraq, some similarities, mostly we make an effort to celebrate the troop, and many say, I support the soldier, but I don't support the war. Well, the constant criticism of the war on many fronts, and the mainstream media constantly looking for the negatives instead of bringing forth many of the positives which are happening in Iraq. This constant drumming of criticism against their efforts when maybe they've just seen one of their friends killed by an IED or in a firefight, or maybe in many cases men that they didn't even know, and women, for we have women in Iraq in the military.
You know, Michael, I have to ask you a couple questions, though, because I know what you're talking about. My husband was in Vietnam, too, and when they came home, it's a military thing. It's not so much a civilian thing, because the military is putting you in the war zone. They're putting you in harm's way, and then they send you home, and 48 hours later, you know, you're supposed to be back in a normal civilian. There's got to be a transition there, and that is up to our military. That is up to our government to help these men make that change.
Well, there in the last 6 years, there's been a lot of efforts to expand the funding of the VA, and there was a huge increase 4 or 5 years ago into the VA system, much revamping going on. To be honest with you, I spent $50,000 of my own money in psychotherapy and never came out of these therapy sessions, group therapy, whatever it would be, feeling better than when I went in. We run to drugs and we run to alcohol, which I did. You got a lot of Vietnam vets 30, 40 years later still taking several different medications, trying to get a good night's sleep and trying not to have the recurring nightmares, trying to tone down their temperament, and it's just not happening for many of them.
Are you saying there's no hope then?
Absolutely there's hope, because I do not suffer these symptoms any longer. And to be straightforward about this, I say that it is not a matter of psychiatry is not the way it's to be dealt with. That only stirs, and it will help in some instances to help the symptoms to subside, but it does not give the man the peace that he is, that we are looking for, where we there's just a place that you want to be in your daily life of, we all have situations, of course, but of just a peace in your spirit. And these guys are not reaching that point. And then you have these guys, the soldiers coming back from Iraq, and they're angry because, again, of this constant rejection of their efforts. They've given their best. They've spent a year through a lot of different elements, 125 to 130 degrees in the summertime in Iraq right now.
I have to interrupt you just a second, because one of the other problems that I think they're having is not only the rejection by civilians, because most civilians do agree it's not the troops' fault. They're there doing the job that they were asked to do. Mm-hmm. But I don't think they're real happy when they keep re-upping them without their permission, because we do have a voluntary army now. It's a lot different than when it was a drafted army or military in general. Now this is voluntary. Some of them did not expect that this was going to happen. They were National Guard. They never thought they were going to go overseas. In Vietnam and during the Vietnam War, people joined the National Guard so they didn't have to go overseas.
That's correct.
And now it's changed. It's changed drastically. And they're re-upping them 2 and 3 terms. That's what's getting them upset. Not so much the coming home and that making that transition, in my opinion.
Well, I personally witnessed, at least in my, I was in Iraq 105 days total at that, not at one stretch, but I personally witnessed 12 men re-enlist and voluntarily re-enlist. Yes, some segments are being, I understand, are being extended. Their time is being extended some, but I also know many who are not being kept in the military. They are being released, so that problem is not quite as widespread as it might seem.
Why are we seeing the high suicide rate in Iraq as opposed to other wars?
Well, and again, I was suicidal. That came to a head in 1999. Then in the 80s, when all the movies Platoon and Full Metal Jacket and Apocalypse Now and et cetera were coming out, Deer Slayer, you sit there and you're drinking and you're talking, and then maybe a lot of guys will just pull away and we just drink by ourselves just to get numb and sleep through the night and stay up late drinking and hoping to get 4 or 5 straight hours before we have to get up and face the next day of work and go to work. The suicide rate is, I believe, what happens in suicide, there's despair and then there's hopelessness that these things will never leave you. And post-traumatic stress disorder is not exclusive to a military man. Post-traumatic stress disorder. This can be something suffered by a woman who is suffering, who was sexually abused growing up as a child by one who was supposed to protect her.
Mm-hmm.
This can be suffered by firemen and is being suffered by firemen and policemen who witness this or that or under constant vigilance. And these recurring attacks in your thought life and against you, you start a depression will starts to come on you. This depression is another symptom, a major symptom of PTSD. And as I experienced in my case, and as I work with men and women who are suicidal, again, I don't work with drugs. The way I was delivered from these things was plain through coming to Jesus as my Lord and Savior, and this is the way I pray with soldiers.
Oh, yeah, and absolutely, you know, I think everyone has to find their own way. But what I was saying about the suicidal rate, it's not after they come home. The suicide rate in Iraq is more than it ever was in any other war.
Well, something that you have more than we have ever had in our, last 50 years in society is, let us say, I saw some of this in Iraq with the soldiers. You would notice a change in a man, and men, I'm only speaking to men, I'm sure it happens with women, but I was not in the presence of women as soldiers there nearly as much as with men. They would get a letter from home from their wife who was leaving them. They would...
That happened in Vietnam, too.
Well, yes, but our society now is a little bit more prolific about this.
I agree with you 100%, Michael. I'm running out of time here. Doggone it. Can I have you come back?
Absolutely.
This is something that we need to discuss. We need to discuss in more detail. If you don't mind, I really want to have you back again.
Well, I would certainly like to be back because there's much more to speak to, and I would like to little more clear with your listeners about how I was delivered from PTSD, and that's through Jesus Christ.
You're going to come back. I will call you when we get off the air so we can schedule.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Michael. You've been so super for sharing the information with us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. That's Michael Caine. It's something that we have to face, folks. These men and women are coming home. They're going to be part of our society, and we're going to have to deal with it. We always deal with everything we possibly can on Pop Off to make it a better life for you. In the meantime, live simply, laugh often, love deeply. And above all else, you dare to dream. And you know what? When you see a soldier coming home, go over and tell him, welcome home, him and her. Talk with you tomorrow on Pop Off. Yeah.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.